for many, technology is part of everyday life. You might check your phone first thing in the morning and right before you go to bed. You could track your diet on an app, post on Facebook, and maybe even adjust your thermostat at home while you're still at work.
But not all technology is helpful, and sometimes it commits some pretty big blunders. And our guest says that can alienate users, perpetuate stereotypes, and affect decisions on hiring and criminal sentencing.
Sarah Wachter-Betcher is the author of the new book, Technically Wrong: Sexist Apps, Biased Algorithms, and Other Threats of Toxic Tech. Sarah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I think a lot of us look at a piece of technology or a program or something, and part of our brains thinks, well, that's objective. That doesn't have any human input in it. We can trust it. And that's part of reading your book. That's part of where we go wrong, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I think it's normal that so many of us do that, because I think, you know, that's kind of the image that technology has projected to us for a lot of years, that it is neutral and unbiased. But the reality is it's all made by people, and people have biases. All of us do. And so those things can make their way right into tech products.
And you've been in the industry yourself, and you write that you started paying attention to how products are designed, and you notice that they're often full of, quoting here, blind spots, biases, and outright ethical blunders. Can you give us some examples of what you started to run across?
Yeah, absolutely. So it started happening a few years ago, where I had started noticing in my own life that, you know, I couldn't use certain forms online, that they wouldn't accept my name because it's too long and has a hyphen and whatever. And those are just kind of petty little things that would be really frustrating, though, where I would be, you know, getting these error messages that my name was rejected. But then I also noticed all these other examples. They just started kind of creeping in, where there were systems that were asking for too much information, where they were demanding too much, you know, data about your gender and about your background and about your identity. And then one day, a really tragic thing happened to my friend Eric Meyer that we actually made us start talking to each other and write a book for people in our industry, which was he went onto Facebook to kind of see what was going on. It was Christmas time. He wanted to get a sense of, you know, all of the different photos of his friends and family, opening presents and whatnot. And what he got instead was this really, really painful reminder, which is Facebook had been promoting its thing called Year in Review, which was these little albums that they would put onto your profile saying, like, here's your highlights from the year. And they wanted you to share them with people. So they would take your most popular content that you'd posted all year and kind of repackage it up for you. And the most popular thing he had posted that year wasn't something he wanted to be reminded of and had never asked for. It was a photo of his daughter, Rebecca, who had actually died on her 6th birthday that year of a aggressive brain cancer. And so that Facebook, you know, put that back in front of him. And not only that, but surrounded it by their own graphics of like people dancing at a party and balloons and streamers, and said, hey, Eric, here's what your year looked like. And he was just heartbroken by it. So that was an example of a tech company sort of taking his content and putting it out of context and inserting it into this place that he'd never agreed to, didn't want, and that was really hurtful. And from there, I just started talking to people about this and asking questions and poking around. And suddenly I was flooded with examples of bias or lack of foresight being built into tech products, and that affecting everything from, you know, like little design decisions in a Snapchat filter that ends up with, you know, an Asian stereotype filter that is really offensive when it's supposed to be a filter that makes you look like you're in an anime, to bias and algorithms that are being used in software to decide how long somebody's criminal sentence should be.
And that's a great example, a horrible example, but a really good example of what you talk about in the book. Nobody at Facebook said, let's find this parent whose child died and rub their face in that. They have this algorithm that they've programmed to do a thing, to pull out information from that user and show it to them, and then they step back and let it rip. And this causes trouble, not just in that way, in a lot of ways, right?
Absolutely. And I think that more and more of our technology is being algorithmically driven, because that's how you can deal with this huge amount of data, right? Like, nobody at Facebook is going to sit down and think about your and my highlights of the year individually. You have to do that programmatically. But when you do that, you take on risks. And the way that they did that, you know, had a lot of flaws in it. And nobody meant for this to happen. There's a lot of really great people who work at Facebook. I actually know a woman who was on the team that launched that product, and it broke her heart when she saw this story. I mean, she did not want this to happen. But it is definitely what happens more and more, and sometimes in really scary ways, when we are not training people in the technology industry to think about the, you know, social or emotional or political impact of the work that they're doing, and we're not kind of bringing in a more diverse set of voices into the technology and design process.
Let's talk about that diverse set of voices. There have been controversies in Silicon Valley over diversifying technology companies, and then pushback from people within the technology industry sometimes. You make the case that it's not just diversity from its own sake, that design failures happen when you don't have a diverse group of people, of engineers and designers at the helm. How does that happen?
Yeah, well, I would say that that happens in a number of ways. The first thing that I think is really important is that we all have blind spots. I mean, are you familiar with any of the inattentional blindness studies where they have people watch a video of basketball players passing a ball around and then tell them to count the number of times, you know, the people in the white shirt pass the ball? And halfway through the video, they have somebody in a gorilla suit jump onto the video and beat their chest and then walk off screen. And every single time they do this experiment, it's been done so many times, 50% of the people who watch that, they don't see the gorilla. Brains are really bad at seeing details that they're not expecting. And in the tech industry, if you have a really narrow group of people that's designing products and they only have the perspective and experience that they have, and they're not actively being trained to look beyond that, they're simply going to miss out on a lot. So having more diverse people in the room will absolutely make a difference if those people are empowered to actually speak up and are able to get into positions of authority where they actually have the ability to steer the direction of products and to say something if they see something come by that is problematic.
You share the story of a company that was trying to design a watch, like a competitor to an Apple Watch sort of arrangement, but one targeted at women. Can you tell that story? Because it went haywire. It ultimately never came to market.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it did in a way, and not in a good way. So that is a story about a woman I spoke with who is a Middle Eastern American designer, and she was working in Silicon Valley at this innovation center. So an innovation center in Silicon Valley typically means like a big corporation will create this kind of small hub there where they're doing the interesting and exciting new stuff. So, you know, like a lot of car companies have them, et cetera. But this was one for a company that was doing more, communications technology. And in her role there, she was going to lead design research, so actually talking to people and figuring out what it was they were going to design for this product that was going to target women as a smartwatch. And so they wanted it to be something that would be kind of that like mid-market Macy's level design, you know, and they wanted it to be something that women would find fashionable and want to wear. So she goes into the first meeting and there's simply no other women in the room. It's just her. And she's like, okay, well, that's okay, you know, here we are. And as soon as she's in there, everybody in the room is talking over her and saying like, well, you know, my wife says this and my wife says that. And she's sitting there going, what if we did real research though, like talk to some actual women instead of just trying to extrapolate from the, you know, like the wives of the people in the room. And she just couldn't really get a word in edgewise. It was just such an insistence that they already understood the quote unquote female market. And so when she went out and did her research, she found some really interesting things. So one of the things that she had found that was very clear in the research was that a primary use case for this smartwatch was that women said they needed to be able to kind of like quietly stay on top of stuff while they were in a meeting. So for example, if they had kids, they wanted to be able to know if they ever got a message that, you know, there was a problem at daycare. And they wanted to be able to keep track of that kind of stuff and never be inaccessible, but they didn't want it to be obvious. They didn't want to be looking at their phones. And she was really taking note of these kinds of insights, right? When she brings them back to the group, they're just unable to listen to them. Just like, no, no, no. Women want this stuff for leisure time. It's just for exercise and shopping. And they just couldn't hear her. Eventually, the project really stalled. They just didn't have any direction for it. So they brought in a celebrity to help market this thing. And the product entirely flopped. It wasn't based off of what people actually needed. It was just based off of some stereotypes about what women are looking for. And, you know, that's one example, but I've heard like 1,000 stories like that, because as soon as you start asking people who work in Silicon Valley, they just come out of the woodwork. Like, women just keep coming to me and telling me very similar stories.
We're talking to Sarah Wachter-Betcher. She's the author of the new book, Technically Wrong: Sexist Apps, Biased Algorithms, and Other Threats of Toxic Tech. One high stakes thing that can go wrong, those biased algorithms in the title of your book, used in everything from hiring decisions to sometimes criminal sentencing. Can you talk about the sort of garbage in, garbage out that can really create problems for people in algorithms?
Absolutely. So one example that I talk about in the book came out of an investigation that ProPublica did last year on software called Compass, which is used in criminal sentencing. And what Compass does is it assigns a risk score for recidivism. And what ProPublica found in their evaluation was that it was systematically giving Black defendants higher scores than white defendants, even when they had similar criminal backgrounds. And the underlying problem is really in how they're deciding what risk means and where that data is coming from. So effectively, what you end up doing when you create an algorithm like that is you have to feed the algorithm a lot of historical information about things like people with criminal backgrounds. Well, if you happen to believe, like I do, that in the past we've had racist policies around policing and we've had higher rates of incarceration for Black people that are unfair, and you're using that data as the basis to form your future predictions, then you're not going to stop that problem. You're actually just going to recreate that problem, but you're going to hand the keys over to the machine. So instead of a human person having to make the decision, like a judge, it's just like, oh, well, the machine said this person was high risk. So it just sort of reduces the responsibility of the person, but it doesn't necessarily reduce the bias whatsoever.
And then I want to look at social media, Twitter and Facebook. You write about, you know, obviously these things have been successful products. A lot of people use them, and a lot of people have found that they're really great for hate mobs, hate speech, interfering in elections, that sort of thing. And you, again, see at the core here a design problem in the way social media is set up and maintained. How could we do that better?
Yeah, well, I think that social media is obviously very powerful, and I'm a big fan of it. I use it. I'm not trying to tell people they shouldn't be using it or that it hasn't brought a lot of good into my life. However, I think that if you look at something like Twitter, that's a product that at its core was designed around this concept of an update. So, you know, you kind of can send these short little messages out into the void. Originally, like the way it was conceived of was really to be similar to how, you know, delivery drivers and bike messengers would send out little updates about their location over CB radios. Like that was sort of the concept that launched Twitter originally. And because that was its kind of original core idea, it took them a really long time to recognize that people were using it to abuse other people in sort of mass coordinated attacks. And I would argue that it took them way too long to recognize that and to start to do anything about it. It was really only last summer when Leslie Jones, who was the one of the actors in the new Ghostbusters, when she was being attacked with a ton of racist, vile threats and rape threats, it was really only after that had happened that they kind of started paying attention and saying, yeah, 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 we're going to do something about this. But here we are a year later, and most of those features really haven't been implemented. So I think it's a matter of a lot of misplaced priorities where people put it off for a very long time and now are facing some dire consequences.
Sarah, briefly, as we wrap up, you've been making this argument in this book and elsewhere. Are people starting to listen, do you think?
I think they are. I think 2017 is almost a little bit of a turning point because it's been a weird year. And we are now seeing, for example, Facebook coming under fire from federal investigators for allowing, you know, Russian-backed organizations to buy up all these ads during the election last year. Like, that's really just starting to get uncovered. I think that this year, people are starting to push back against technology in ways that they haven't in the past, and because they've realized the risks that are involved. And I'm really excited about that, because I think that we're going to have a lot better conversations about technology the more that we push back against its overreach and stop assuming that it's necessarily right.
Sarah, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Sarah Wachter-Betcher. Her new book is Technically Wrong: Sexist Apps, Biased Algorithms, and Other Threats of Toxic Tech.
Coming up after the news, we'll get book recommendations for fall reading season here on Central Time.